My spider senses are starting to tingle.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
If you could have another sense beyond the normal five, what would you want?
X-ray vision? Echolocation?
Would you want to smell what a dog can smell? See what a snake can see? Hear what a bat can hear?
You don't act blind. You knew I had no furniture. How?
Confidence. And also I've mastered the art of echolocation.
How easy is it to hack the brain and add novel senses?
It's just a matter of a new way of getting data in there.
Our guest is neuroscientist David Eagleman, author of The Brain, The Story of You.
We can build senses because it's all about just what the peripheral detectors are. And I think we're going to really get to see what it is when people are having a direct perceptual experience of other things.
Spider sense tingling.
Hacking the brain beyond the five senses.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help now more than ever.
So here's what you do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
Holding hands at midnight, 'neath a starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
Are humans limited to the senses we're born with?
Or is it possible to hack the brain and create new senses?
Even if we could, would we want more senses than we already have?
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford University campus, where Ken teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're hacking the brain. We're thinking about the possibility of perception beyond the ordinary five senses.
Hacking the brain, Ken? That sounds a little scary.
No, Josh, come on. It's not scary at all. It's really exciting. I mean, imagine being able to add novel human senses at will. You know, like we could have the ability to perceive magnetic fields like birds already do. I mean, come on. Wouldn't that be like awesomely mind-blowing? Come on.
Maybe. But what are we actually talking about here? Are you talking about something like, you know, putting on night vision goggles? Or is it more like a brain implant?
Brain implants. No, Josh, that's so science fiction. I'm talking about, actually, think of something really simple. Really simple. The most simple technology imaginable for helping someone with impaired senses, like canes that blind people use to see.
Wait, hang on. Blind people don't use canes to see. I mean, the cane helps them to navigate, but they're not actually seeing something.
Oh, okay. They don't see with the cane. But the cane is actually a lot more than a navigation tool. You know, the phenomenologist Merleau-Ponty says about the cane, it gets incorporated into the blind person's body. I mean, come on. It's an extension of her hand. So maybe she can't see the ground with her cane, but you know what? She can literally feel the ground with something as simple as a cane.
Literally?
Oh, don't get hung up on a word. Come on, the point is, the blind person's brain has been, in a sense, hacked. Without any brain implant, without any tinkering with her sensory apparatus, all we needed to do was give her a simple cane.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's fantastic that it works like that, but how does it count as hacking the brain?
Oh, shot. Okay, come on, think about it. What does the brain do with the cane? It takes in information from the cane. And then what does it do with that information? It integrates it seamlessly into our experience, so seamlessly that the cane now starts to feel like a part of the body, like a part of the perceptual system. And that's really cool, and that's all it takes to hack the brain.
Yeah, okay, look, if that's all you mean by hacking the brain, then all right, it's not scary, but I mean, is it that exciting? I'm not going to accuse you of reinventing the wheel, but aren't you reinventing the stick?
You're a literary guy, right?
Uh-huh.
Use your imagination. Look, if something as simple as, technologically simple as a cane can be a way into the brain, imagine what new and exciting things we could do to hack the brain with sophisticated modern technology. I mean, did you know this? I mean, there are these smart vests that not only do they allow blind people to see, but they also allow deaf people to hear, and they do it using vibrations in the skin. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, but you're playing fast and loose with language again, Ken. I mean, look, a blind person with a cane can't actually see anything, and a blind person with a vest couldn't see anything either.
No. Look, you're just missing the point. I mean, first of all, I can't see with the cane, but I can feel with the cane. But still, the vest and the cane are really different, and that's important, Jess, because think of what the vest does. The vest takes in lots of visual information from the environment. It translates that visual information into vibrations. Those vibrations are translated to the brain. The brain does all these complicated computation and structures a complex picture of the environment. And lo and behold, you're seeing.
So wait, okay, you're saying that the vest is like a whole new sensory organ.
That's it, Josh, you got it. And it's not just about enhancing senses we already have. Just imagine the possibilities.
Well, all right. I mean, I got to admit, Ken, between you and me, ever since I read Thomas Nagel, I kind of have had a hankering to know what it's like to be a bat. So can I have some echolocation?
Yeah, we can do that.
And maybe a little x-ray vision like Professor Xavier?
Yeah, why not, Justin? Right. Now you're getting it. And you know what? These new developments are going to change our very sense of what it means to be a human being. So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to find out how new sensory technologies can make us think about who we are in whole new ways. She files this report.
When I first interview Kristen Neidlinger, she tells me how I'm feeling. She says, it looks like you're mooding.
You're pretty aesthetic, like pretty blissful.
I'm wearing a device she invented called a mood sweater. It's actually more like a soft scarf. The device translates the electrical properties on my skin into colors.
We have blue, which is like focused. Red is nervous, in love. And then a warm white, which is ecstatic.
When I tried on this mood sweater, I was nervous about what Kristen might see. I'm pretty sure I have some kind of deep-rooted anger. Maybe I'm even a little vengeful, but I don't want her to know that. Kristen is pushing beyond our human abilities and human instincts to communicate our feelings.
I think there's so much power in being vulnerable. It's so healthy, because you can't bottle everything in.
This mood sweater is not the only technology designed to push the limits of human senses.
I start to think we were truly beginning to make ourselves into cyborgs by putting all of this technology onto our bodies.
Cara Platoni wrote a book titled We Have the Technology about transhumanists, biohackers, perfumers, picklers, and others trying to do just that.
It was almost a way to make ourselves superhuman and to kind of bypass the limits of slow, boring, clunky evolution by engineering ourselves better bodies.
At one point, she even turned into a cow. That is, she put on a virtual reality device that made her believe she was a cow.
Even though I had only been a cow in this virtual world for maybe 10 minutes, I really identified with this cow.
So there she was, a cow roaming in a happy meadow, when all of a sudden she heard a voice.
We want you to turn around and go back to where you started, because you're being sent to the slaughterhouse. And at that very moment, the ground started to shake, and there was the sound of a truck backing up, and it was incredibly scary.
The idea is that if you spend some time being a cow, you might empathize more with animals. Like the mood sweater, virtual reality experiments like that one are meant to hack our perception of who we are. But there are also people studying what happens when our sense of self comes apart.
Normally, if I were to ask you, do you exist, you would consider that a pretty silly question. I mean, of course you exist, and that's something we take for granted.
Anil Ananthaswamy is the author of The Man Who Wasn't There. He spoke with people who suffer from Cotard syndrome and who are convinced they no longer exist.
Someone who is suffering from Cotard's, unfortunately, will have this perception of being dead or not existing. And it's very, very hard for someone who's not in that state to even understand what that means.
People with Cotard syndrome can't rationalize themselves out of this new reality. It's a cruel and rare illness, but it's also a reminder that our sense of self is vulnerable.
if everything is working okay, then that's fine, but then these things can come apart. We are all kind of sitting on a knife edge in terms of feeling whole and complete.
It's a scary idea, and a lot of hackers and scientists are already frustrated by the limits of human perception. We can expand our sense of who we are by, for instance, putting on a mood sweater or wearing a virtual reality headset. But it's also possible to lose our sense of reality completely. And no matter how hard we try, turning into a cow won't bring it back. I'm called a cow. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that mind-bending tour of the gateways of perception, Holly. I'm Ken Taylor, along with my Stanford colleague, Joshua Landy. And we're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
Our guest today is a neuroscientist at Stanford University. He's author of The Brain, The Story of You, and host of the PBS TV series that's based on it. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, David Eagleman.
Hey. Welcome, David.
Great to see you.
So, David, as a neuroscientist, there's many aspects of the brain you could be studying. You used to think a lot about freedom and justice and the law in neuroscience. So what in particular got you interested in sense and sense perception of the neuroscience thereof?
I've just always been fascinated by the fact that your brain is locked in silence and darkness inside your skull, and yet it's constructing all of this. Everybody hear the sounds, all that stuff, and yet when you look inside the brain, it's all just electrical spikes. That's all we see there. So that I got really interested in trying to understand how we create senses from that material.
And what do you think about what we were arguing about earlier, Ken and me? You know, he was being all naive and gung-ho about, you know, how great it's going to be. We're going to create these new ways of perceiving the world. And I was trying to be sensible and skeptical and suggest, well, is that really a new sense? What do you think as an actual neuroscientist?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we can build senses because it's all about just what the peripheral detectors are. So you pick up photons with your eyes, you pick up air compression waves with your ears, molecules with your nose, and you have these qualia, this internal experience going on there. And so I think it's absolutely the case that we can build new peripheral detectors and plug them in.
So wait a minute. That means I wasn't being gung-ho and naive, right? Let's just get this straight, right?
Quite right.
All right, okay, Josh is wrong. Yeah. But let's talk about the qualia, because I think that's really interesting. Yeah. I love the, you know, ignoring my earlier skepticism, I love the idea of all these new devices. What I'm curious about is, will the qualia be different? And there's something it's like to smell something, and that's different from what it's like to taste something or what it's like to see something.
Yeah.
So will it feel, will there be a different kind of experience?
Especially because all I've read about this so far is mostly what we do is exploit new pathways for old information. It's not like we give ourselves, the vibrations, the brain senses vibrate, you know. So it's not like something new, but it takes light and turn it into vibration. So why believe that they're going to be new qualia?
Well, I think qualia is just an informational issue, which is to say the reason smell feels so different than sound and touch and vision, you would never confuse us. You would never smell something and think, oh, I just saw something great there. And so I think it has to do with the structure of the data coming in. And if you feed data in with a different kind of structure, the data is different, then you're going to have a different qualia.
Wait a minute, slow down. So if I use, take some light, translate it into vibrations on the skin. Okay, so the light's not going through my optic nerve and all that. It's going through this vest. That's your vest, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the making vibrations is going to the brain. Are you telling me that the light caused vibrations and the vibrations from the rumbling sound that impacts my body, are they going to be received differently from my brain? I mean, does the brain know what got the vibrations there? Does it care what got them there?
It does know because it figures it out. So your brain's just trying to sense informational sources from the world, something that's useful. So whether that's, you know, sounds or sights or whatever, it figures it out. In the case of translating sight or sound, I have a suspicion that the qualia will be the same as if you saw it or heard it. Where it gets interesting is when we feed in completely new kinds of information streams, whether that's stock market or Twitter or
whatever.
Tell
them about your stock market thing. tell these folks about your, really quickly.
Oh, yeah, well, it's easy. So we've built this vest with the vibratory motors, which Ken mentioned, and Yeah, we can feed in, for example, stock market data. So you're feeling, you know, 32 different stocks, and you can tell what's going on.
And if you do this really right, you don't have to go to the NSF anymore.
Oh, yeah, and be done running grants. So so it turns out when we're feeding in something totally new like that, that's where you have the chance of developing a new qualia. And I assume we're going to talk more about that after the break.
We will. This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater in San Francisco. Our guest is neuroscientist David Eagleman.
Philosopher Thomas Nagel famously asked what it's like to be a bat. Are we now in a position to find out? Would you want to wear a vest that feeds echolocation data to your brain? What do you think it would be like to perceive the world in that way?
Perception, sensation, and new information, along with questions from our sensational live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Tiffany Austin Quartet. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is neuroscientist David Eagleman, and we're thinking about hacking the brain.
Would you want to augment your natural-born senses with newfangled, technologically produced senses? What senses would you choose? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone in front of the stage.
So, David, okay, you've actually, I take it, have experienced some of this novel perceiving of the world yourself through some of the technology that you and your team have created. So there's a lot of philosophical and technical questions I have for you, but can you start by telling us what it's like to have these new sensory experiences?
Yeah, so we've done this in various ways. So just as an example, we can tell what's going on in the world around you and put that onto the vest. So let's say I'm blind and you're walking up. I feel that you're on my left and Josh is on my right. Let's say you walk behind me. I can feel exactly where you are. And it turns out that there's zero learning curve with this. It's just unbelievably easy to get it because it's some sort of sense of space.
And I assume, if I understand correctly, the difference between somebody telling you there's somebody on your left and somebody on your right versus this experience is, would I be right in thinking it's immediacy, that you know without having to think about it?
Exactly right. It's a direct perceptual experience without any need for translation.
But you said there's no learning curve. I was looking at some, there's some app, I forget what it's called, that you can use into your browser or your cell phone. And it's for blind people.
By the voice.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. And I played with that last night. And they showed this video of, I think, a blind person picking out objects on the basis of being acclimated. I mean, I couldn't make any sense of what was going on. But for that thing, they seemed to suggest, I read some of the literature, that there is a kind of like training thing that you have to do, like a neural net or something.
Yeah, exactly. You have to train up on that because that's taking vision and turning it to sound. And you can't just plug that directly in and have the brain understand. So people have to learn by interacting with the world and figuring out what's out there. Exactly. What's different about the sense of space is that that's sort of a fundamental sense that we have coming into the world. And so it's very easy to do that. And we've done various things
with
that.
Is that because... all of our sensory modality, except maybe smell, except I guess for dogs though, but for humans, most of our sensory modality have a kind of spatial mapping.
Exactly. So space is what we call metamodal, meaning it lives on top of vision and hearing and so on. Yeah, exactly. So one of the things I did with this, actually, I'm a scientific advisor for the show Westworld, and so I...
Oh, really? Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't there a moment when people are wearing vests in...
Yeah, yeah, that's my vest. Yeah, exactly. So
I'm on your job.
Okay. All right, we'll talk afterwards. So, so we had, you know, for those of you who know the show, the robots go bad and private military contractors drop in to take care of this. Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
And they're wearing the vest. And in this case, the vest is telling them where the androids are, so they can feel in the dark and when they're on the other side of a wall and so on where they are.
So let me ask you a question about space. You said it's the perception of space. You said it's multimodal. Because here's one of the things I wonder about. It may seem like a naive question, but I wonder, because you talk about new senses, and I think, well, what exactly is a sense? How do I read something by a philosopher friend of mine that says, we're wrong to count five senses. Lots of people say that because they mean proprioception, but he means more than that. He means like, there's like 20 senses. And I say, well, what makes a sense, right? So I don't know if there's, is there a like formal answer? Because then I want to know what's the difference between repurposing an old sense for a new purpose and giving us a new sense, right? I mean, so
there's two separate questions there. So one is, yeah, what do we count as a sense? Essentially any information source from the world. So whether that's proprioception or vibration or temperature or whatever, you know, anything that you can get info from and act on it, that we can count as
a
sense.
So is vibration versus like pressure, is that a different sense?
Or? Different, yeah, yes. Exactly right. And in fact, in your skin, it's this incredible computational material. You've got a whole zoo of receptors in there for stretch, itch, pain, temperature, all kinds of things. So that's how you can sort of straightforwardly define a sense. But your question then is about, can you repurpose a sense?
Right.
Can you feed a different kind of information? And I certainly think so, because, for example, with our vest, you've got 32 different motors on the torso. And what you're picking up, let's say for deaf people learning language, is this the pattern of it across your whole torso. And that's something you've never had before. Mm-hmm. And that emerges as a different kind of qualia.
I see.
Okay, so, I mean, I totally buy that. And obviously, I understand it. There are cases of people with an impairment in one sense gaining greater skills in another sense. But don't we bump up at a certain point against limits in processing capacity? I mean, isn't it a zero-sum game? Could you really add a sense without taking away real estate from another sense?
Great, great question. The brain is extraordinarily good at sharing real estate in ways that we don't totally understand how it's so good at it, but we know that it is. So you can plug in all kinds of new things and the brain will just figure out how to share the territory. Now, does this mean we can create a sixth sense? Certainly. Seventh, yes. Eighth, maybe. So I don't know what the limit is. We won't ask me again in 5 years and I'll be able to have a better answer about what the limits are.
Tell me if this is true. I think I read. So people who are blind, so the visual cortex, right? People who are blind, the visual cortex doesn't just lay there inactive. It starts helping process other bits of information.
It gets recruited.
Right, so it gets recruited. How the brain does that, that's a really interesting question. You know, if I were a young man starting over, I would either be a biologist or a neuroscientist or something, and then do philosophy. But how is that right?
That's totally
different
right.
Parts of the brain get recruited?
Totally right. The brain doesn't let anything lie fallow, so it takes over. In fact, what we now know is that it's unbelievably rapid. So if I take you into the lab and blindfold you, within 90 minutes, we can see activity in your visual cortex from touch, from sound, from other things like that. Starts taking over rapidly. Yeah.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about hacking the brain and creating senses beyond the common five in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater in San Francisco. And we've got some questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. What's your comment or question?
Thank you. My name's Richard. I'm from England, but I live in San Francisco. I can see how this would help people with severe disabilities. But we're already suffering a chronic, dreadful problem in society because of our so-called smart devices. People are not recognizing facial expressions. They're not holding doors. I see people here today videoing you while they're actually watching the program, presumably so they can go bore their friends later. Wouldn't this just put the tin lid on it?
Good question. What do you think, David?
Well, I happen to be a real cyber optimist. I don't share your view. No, I mean, take what kids, I mean, we all grew up, it was being stuck with our homeroom teacher. Now, I run into 12-year-olds all the time who say stuff really smart. I say, how do you know that? They said, I saw it on a TED Talk. They have access to the entirety of humankind's knowledge at their fingertips all the time. I think the next generation we will see is going to be much smarter than we are. So I'm actually quite a fan of where things are going technologically.
Is that because you believe in the singularity? They're going to merge artificial and human intelligence?
That's a separate issue, which I'm happy to talk about. But no, I just think in terms of the educational opportunities that kids have available, it's really remarkable.
I mean, there's certainly opportunities, but don't you also see some negative consequences?
Here's what I think this show might not be the right time to talk about this, but generally on par, I think that kids are going to be much better off than we are. And it's not like we didn't waste tons of time when we were growing up doing really stupid stuff.
But
talk to yourself.
But here's the thing. So, look, there, we ask everybody to turn their cell phones off. But if you turned your cell phone on, there's all kinds of information. This room is awash in information that you can't detect without unaided, right? It's just a wash in it. And if we never had these devices, this is a counterpoint. If we never had these devices, we wouldn't be blind, deaf, and dumb, but there was so much that we wouldn't know. I mean, you couldn't go to the doctor and get an X-ray or an MRI. So we make these devices that in effect extend our sensory apparatus.
Yeah, and okay, by the way, I don't think this puts that my device has put the lid on this. I think this is just the next device stream
so what
of
I'm
devices.
Wondering,
that'll
be, but yeah. Wouldn't it be good? What would be wrong if evolution was given time? It would probably design us to pick up more of the information in the world, because how is less information better than more information?
Quite right. I totally agree, and I think we've got the room to store it and build this in, and this is what we're good at. And so, this is what the coming decade is going to show us, I think. So, as you know, I've spun off a company called NeoSensory that's building these devices, and I think we're going to really get to see what it is when people are having a direct perceptual experience of other things. Just as one example, I recently hooked up drone pilots, so they're feeling the pitch, yaw, roll, orientation, and heading of their drone while they're flying it. It is like extending your skin up to the drone. It's like you become one with the drone, and you can feel what's going on.
So there's an argument in Descartes' meditation, in Meditation 6, for why the mind and the body, he says the mind and the body are metaphysically distinct, but he says, I am joined to my body in an intimate way. I'm not attached to my body like a pilot in a ship. And what he means by that is a pilot in a ship just reads the dials and doesn't have any kind of direct awareness of the body. But we have this kind of direct awareness through our sensation of pain and all this other stuff of our body. And basically, you're telling me, if Descartes' right, then the world is our body, can become our body, or a lot more of the world can become, as it were, part of our body.
Oh, exactly. And of course, we're already used to this. I mean, I drove up here in my truck, and when I'm in the driver's seat, I feel like the vehicle is mine. And if I hit a bump with the right driver's tire, then it feels like I've hit something.
It's pain to your body.
Exactly. And of course, I can get on a bicycle, I can get on skis, and these all become extensions of the body.
So I can imagine, you write fiction.
I do.
You study fiction.
Do you write
fiction too?
No.
Yeah. You told me that you're
kind to the world.
Yeah. But I can imagine some poet someday who's had David's sensory experience. You know, I think there's a line in the Bible or something. I was blind, but now I see. Mm-hmm. Well, there'll be all these senses of which we could say I lacked X, but now I have it, and there'll be all this poetry that comes forth.
Okay, but here's the interesting part. So, So imagine a new color. Take a moment to imagine a new color.
Okay.
Okay, it's totally impossible, right? You just can't do it.
Yeah.
Okay, imagine a new qualia. Imagine what it would be like, not just if you had sense and smell and hearing and touch, but something else, and it turns out you can't do it. And so what I think is going to happen is, when I wear the vest and take in drone data, and you get Twitter data, and you get stock market data, and so on, we won't be able to communicate with each other what it actually feels like.
Oh, my goodness.
And we can try, and we can pretend to understand, but we won't understand. In the same way, if you try to explain vision to a blind person,
right,
she can't get it. She can pretend she has, but she can't.
But that sounds like the kind of downside we were talking about earlier, right? We had a great question about, aren't there going to possibly be downside? That, I mean, sounds like you're talking about increased mutual isolation. Everyone's going to have their own 6th or 7th or 20th sense.
The question,
and we won't be able to, will be even harder for us to communicate.
Well, we're kind of already in that.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. People have very different cultures, different childhoods, different capacities. They care about different stuff. If you really love swimming and competitive swimming and I love something else, I mean, like, our worlds are so different already.
Yeah. Let's take some more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Thank you. My name is Esmeralda and I'm from San Francisco. And is it not possible that the human body is an inanimate object that's merely informed by consciousness? And the second part of my question is, has any of you ever taken LSD?
Well, they're going to answer that on the radio.
And do you have any?
The second one, don't answer in the radio.
I can answer because my answer is no. But I, but I'm fascinated in general by what we learned from that stuff from the neuroscience point of view. And my interpretation, look, I mean, a lot of people say, look, I tapped into a cosmic XYZ. I think what it demonstrates is we know how it binds to receptors and what happens. It knocks the processing of the brain off by 3% in some weird direction. And what it demonstrates to me is how fragile reality is and consciousness is. All you need is just to stick some chemical in there and suddenly you're talking to silver leprechauns and whatever. And so...
But to bring it back to the question of these new senses, I mean, it seems like the point in common we're talking about here is to what extent is our sense of the world impoverished currently?
Right.
Right? Or to put it another way, to what extent would our sense of the world be enhanced and transformed if we were wearing the vest, if we were, you know, all the other possible devices that might come up in the future? Do you think it would just be, well, now I know what my stocks are doing, or would it be more like a transformation of the way in which we experience everything?
Yeah, really, it's transformation is the part I'm interested in. Just as one example, you know, we see a very, very narrow spectrum of electromagnetic radiation, and we call that visible light.
Right.
But so I built a wristband to be able to pick up on ultraviolet and infrared light, and it's quite extraordinary. Just as, you know, the first night I was wearing it, I suddenly felt a lot of infrared. It was in the dark. I didn't know what was going on. I followed it, and it was an infrared camera with infrared LED lights, which is normally invisible.
Okay, but let me ask you another question, though. On the other side of this, like, okay, I'm gung-ho. Tinker with a human everything, possibly. Tinker with human societies, gender, tinker with everything. But, you know, evolution, which is slow and laborious and discards failures and moves on, is not dumb. That is, so evolution has said, oh yeah, this animal is going to forage at night, so it needs to be able to see in the infrared range. This animal is not going to forage, right? So other than just like, we can do it, so let's do it. I mean, what's the imperative to do that? I mean, again, we have X-ray machines, so why do I need to have X-ray vision, right? I mean, they're useful, but would X-ray vision be useful? Would all these people want me to have X-ray vision? They're like, ooh, you know. So what's, other than the fact that we can do it.
Okay, I got it. So so let me ask you this. If you really,
you know, not
if
that
you
I
really
want
were to
bow
take that
to the
point
wisdom
of view
nature.
About evolution, would you get rid of your car and your washing machine and all of the things evolution didn't give you?
Sometimes I think, yeah, because here's the reason I think yes, sometimes, I don't think it always. The reason sometimes I think, yeah, is because evolution gave human beings a trick. Don't take the environment as given.
Exactly. You got
exploited,
it.
Blah, blah, blah. And that trick is really good, except now that trick has global disastrous implications, this trick. Because the Industrial Revolution, the global warming, all that stuff is a result of this trick.
Okay, but I know we've only got 1 minute left on this section, but the issue is that when you look at any new invention, whether that's, take books and literature. Someone could say exactly the argument. Like, look, we shouldn't make books. We shouldn't have the printing press because maybe somebody will write something bad or evil. Yes exactly. And so maybe what we should do is not go there because evolution hadn't given us books, and so we shouldn't create
I'm not endorsing that argument, but there's a consideration on the other side. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're hacking the brain and thinking about perception beyond the five senses with renowned neuroscientist, advisor to Westworld, and soon-to-be billionaire, David
Would you want to add a bunch of new senses to your current repertoire, or are you happy with the senses that God or Darwin gave you? Will people of the future all have augmented senses?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in San Francisco. We'll take more questions from our very sensible live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
One, two, three, four, five. Senses working overtime. Trying to taste the difference between the lemon and the lime. Pain and pleasure and the church bells softly chime.
Thanks again to our live musical guests, the Tiffany Austin Quartet. They are brilliant. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're hacking the brain and thinking about the senses beyond the ordinary five. We've got questions from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man.
So my question is, have you hooked two people up to the same vest or each have a vest so that we, since we're all in our own realities, we can start to experience other people's realities to connect us instead of?
It's a great question. Yeah, that's exactly one of the things that we're working on now. For example, if I can feel my wife's pulse and galvanic skin response and all sorts of things, will I understand exactly how she's feeling? And she means, so when I'm traveling, when I'm doing a radio show and she's at home, can I suddenly feel like, oh, she's feeling stressed out. I should call and check what's going on there. Somebody recently suggested to me that I should put this at a place of work where everyone feels everyone. I think that's a terrible idea because
I'm stressed out enough as it is.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of language and other things that we do at work is actually about deception. And so, you know, when Bob gets up to give the PowerPoint presentation, he doesn't want everyone to know exactly what his physiology is. So, but I think the one-on-one thing is very interesting. So that's something we're pursuing.
Right. There's lots of technology that threatens the human. Right. But one could imagine a new kind of equality to man, not just equality of income and equality of opportunity, but equality of opportunities for sensing and feeling the world, right? That would be a new
quality
kind of equality.
Right.
Equality of experience.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really think that's any different than the kind of books that are available to you or movies or anything like that. We all try, you know, some of us have access to watching Westworld on HBO and others can't afford the $10 a month to watch HBO. Yeah.
Okay, so I want to take this in a more Pollyanna-ish direction. Okay, because remember what Holly was saying about imagine the virtual reality experience of being a cow and how terrifying that was. Do you think there might be a time when we could deploy this kind of technology to get people to experience what homelessness is like, and that this could actually have beneficial social consequences?
I don't think so for many reasons. First of all, this, we're just feeding in sensation, and so in a sense it's no different than what you could do from reading a book about being homeless. So it could get you there that way. The other thing is, a better approach is something like VR, and some of our colleagues at Stanford are using VR to put people in that situation. The fact is, someone who already has a lot of empathy and cares about homelessness will go and do that VR experience, and others who don't have empathy and don't care about that won't. So
it's a vicious circle.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know if it's that useful.
Welcome to Philosophy Doctor.
Hi, my name is Jody, and this is a question that came up when you were talking about the vest and about spatial awareness. And I come from a dance background, and I've spent many and many a years growing and understanding spatial awareness through a lot of practice. And to give somebody the experience of spatial awareness versus training and really grasping that with some depth, I see that happening a lot is just you're giving people an experience, but the depth is missing with that connection. So I'd just like for you to talk a little bit about that and what you see happening, since we're maybe not, we're given the experience right away, but we're not going through a process with it so much.
I don't think the process part is the part that matters that much. If you can actually learn something better because you have extra senses to be able to take it on, there's no reason why you can't actually be more expert in it. So for example, if you wore the vest and had a sense of exactly where everyone was moving around you and so on, you would just be better at what you're doing. It's not a zero-sum trade-off.
I want to ask you, another kind of question about the neural hardware and how that constrains the possibility. You talked a little bit about this, but I want to focus on it a little bit more. Sometimes I think, okay, there are all these animals with all these cool senses that humans don't share. I think, wow, that's amazing. And I once thought, well, why is it? This goes back to the question, what differentiates one sense from another? I thought, well, they just have different kind of peripheral pathways that pick up different kinds of information. That's part of it, but then their brain is evolved to do something with that information. And then I thought, well, maybe they have a special brain modules, you know, as it were. But then I said, well, the evolution doesn't really reinvent, it just repurposes old stuff. And I'm thinking, well, their brains probably work somewhat like ours in the sensory way. So if we could hook our brains up to that, and I'm trying to figure out what's the limit. Is it the pathway the limit, or is it the computational sensor?
It's just getting
the
data in there. So my view on this is that the brain is a general purpose compute device, and whatever data it receives, it just figures out what to do with it and how to use it. And all of our evidence so far indicates that that is the case.
So if I could find new ways of get, so then I was thinking, okay, so dogs apparently can smell, I don't remember what the number is, but a lot more than us.
Yes.
I assume, I don't know, I don't really know this, but I never asked my dog, but I assume since she delights in smelling things, she explores the world by smelling, I assume that there are different qualia space, a lot richer qualia space for her than for
us. I assume the same.
Right? So I'm thinking, is our brain capable? I mean, it's not just that we don't have the path. Is our brain capable of generating those qualia?
So we have a lot more. So look, we have a certain number of smell receptors, right. Receptors in our nose, and the dog has a big giant snout with many more types in there. And there's no reason to think that if we had access to more peripheral detectors that we wouldn't have a much richer qualia. So that's one of the projects we're doing right now. We're building an artificial molecular detector that feeds its data into, for example, the vest. So imagine a drug agent not needing to have the dog with him because he can feel all the smells and the scents.
Wow,
directly.
That's amazing. So we could actually expand our qualitative
awareness
of the world radically just by
tinkering
with the scent. So this is why it's not brain implants. It's tinkering with the peripheral sources of information.
Oh, yeah. It's just much easier to do it that way because the brain is locked inside the skull. Mother Nature put this armored bunker plating around the brain. It's very hard to get in there, but you can, all this is a way of getting stuff up there.
Welcome to Philosophy Talks here.
Hi, my name is Sebastian Dragne. I'm from San Francisco. It's a great venue where philosophy meets science, shake hands and talk about it, especially with somebody that is involved with Westworld, which has a philosophy bent to it. Question is more from a process standpoint. As you go and explore these new things, from a philosophical standpoint, is there a morality to it? As in, maybe I shouldn't go in that direction. Do you ever encounter those type of, questions for yourself? And if so, what would it be one?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think one of the really important things in science is to always make sure that we're not moving ahead of our moral compass. So I think about that question a lot. In this case, I actually have not been able to generate a compelling reason, though, why there's anything we're doing that's different than building, a book or a television or other things. It's just a matter of a new way of getting data in there. But it would be like if I invented the audiobook and you said, well, wait, what are the moral issues with an audiobook? Well, you could write bad things in an audiobook. You write good things. So I don't think it's really any different than that.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. What's your comment or question?
Hi, I'm Spencer and live in the East Bay. And what I'm interested in is focus. If you want to be a cow, but you're just adding that sensory ability to all of our other abilities, you're not going to have the quality of being a cow. You're going to be a cow on top of a person. And the question is, when you cut out the senses, it's very primitive. You blindfold the person to cut out their sight. You put earplugs over them to cut out their ears, but yet you're trying to be very sophisticated for adding senses. Is there any way other than an anesthetic to cut out the senses so we could get closer to the actual being of some more primitive or different kind of creature?
Yeah, it's a great question. I've written fiction about this particular question, and I think that the closer, so if you wanted to become a cow, you'd have to modify some senses, add other senses, you'd have to do some of both. To the degree that you could become a cow and really be a cow, you would forget what it is to be a human, asking the question what it is to be a cow. If you actually got there, you would no longer remember what the original question was.
And that does not sound like fun.
You might be stuck there is the problem.
David, this has been a sensational conversation. And I'm going to thank you so much for joining us.
Great, thanks so much.
Our guest has been David Eagleman. He's a world-renowned neuroscientist from Stanford University. He's author of The Brain, The Story of You, and he's also host of the PBS TV series based on that book. So, Josh, what are you sensing now? What is your sense of the future?
I say hook me up, Ken. I want all this stuff. I want echolocation. I want to know what it's like to be a bat. I mean, look, we should be cautious. We shouldn't end up in a two-tier society or an even more of a two-tier society. Yeah. We should be careful, but But I think that they're incredible prospects for changing our world. I can't wait to read the new poetry or smell the new poetry or whatever it is that we're going to be doing.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I don't see any downside. I mean, the human being has been trying to enhance. We have been trying to enhance our ways of gathering information about the world since we were around. I mean, we have telescopes and microscopes and television and radio. All that is like new sensation. I mean, it's new. We use tools to do it, right? But the fact that we could just add some tools to our body and that our wonderful, highly plastic brain could go crazy and say, oh, I know how to do that. Why didn't you clue me in on that earlier? It's just amazing. So I kind of agree with that. I was trying to press him to see what the downsides might be, but I don't see any.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah,
hook me up.
This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blago, I think, therefore I blog. We're sorry, Descartes. You can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, either here or if you're listening on the radio, we'd love to hear from you. Email it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on our blog. Now let's hear from someone who always talks past all five senses. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, as hopes for new technology get vaster by the minute, we turn some attention to the theoretical possibility of creating a new sense or senses like precognition, telepathy, telekinesis, or are those superpowers? I don't know. I read that echolocation and magnetoception are considered new senses, though they seem like old senses in a new bag to me. This may be just more of the disruption game we have not yet grown tired of playing. Come on, there's new life yet in the senses we have. True, we overshot the mark a few times. Quadraphonic sound, for instance, we only have 2 ears, so anything more than stereo is a waste of vibrations. Some even believe, and I am one of them, that pop music sounded the best when it was played mono on a car speaker on a hot August Sunday afternoon parked lakeside somewhere in central Minnesota in 1967. 3D is another thing. It failed when I was a kid. Put on special glasses at the movies and somebody would bap a paddle ball at your face or shoot an arrow at you and you'd go home with a slight headache. Worked great now, but it doesn't hold interest for me. I don't go to movies for realism. I'm looking for swell outfits and fight scenes. Black and white is fine with me. Silent works too. More dimensions do not always add to the experience. Sometimes a simple tickle works better than a slap in the face. By and large, movies were better when they were smaller. I like Panavision as much as the next Western fan, but remember Cinerama? Large, boring movies with the screen so wide you got whiplash. You had to watch them in special dome-like cathedrals. Now we either have just normal movies, which are getting to be pretty good again, or giant crappy 3D movies with robots from the future throwing trucks at your head. In the 50s, they also tried to overload our senses by wiring the seats or adding smell-o-vision to the mix, all to compete with television, which boxed up old movies in the privacy of our home. And now television is trying to compete with a computer, which can give us anything we crave on a screen the size of a postage stamp or as big as your living room wall. Sensual entertainment innovations focus on the eye and ear portions of our sensing apparatus. Touch is not an entertainment option unless we're having sex or playing an instrument or making a sculpture. The epitome for smell evocation is perfume. The epitome for taste is a fine meal. And now we're working on immersive artificial environments, virtual reality that you walk around in virtually with dinosaurs and sex workers and ray guns and roller coasters that you can turn off with a switch. But it's all just variations and combinations of the same old senses, it seems to me. If we do come up with a new sense, in order for it to catch on, it would have to be something simple, like sight, sound, touch, flavor, smell. So we know what it is immediately. Flarming, let's call it. We've discovered the sense of flarming. Once we know we have it, we'll flarm for a while, until the novelty wears off. I mean, after the age of 3, you don't exercise touch by poking the couch to see if your finger works. You want things that reward the senses big time. That's how we roll. So we'll come up with Flarm-O-Rama, which lets you flarm much longer, with a measurable increase in flarmability. Old movies will be re-released and colorized with flarm added. Critics will be outraged. Audiences quickly bored as that novelty too wears off. Nostalgia will rear its ugly head. Remember when you could flarm the flarmaroonie without all the bells and whistles? Just good old flarming? I don't know. I still think we haven't used the full potential of the senses we have. Nothing can put you in a mood like a smell. Popcorn, newly mown grass, grandma going to church. You can even smell a thunderstorm before it hits. If you're in the back seat of a car in an August afternoon in central Minnesota listening to the radio in 1967, say, you can smell the lake, sure, but something else. Before you see it coming across the lake, you can smell it in the air like a cold new penny. A storm is coming. So start the car and get out before it hits. Once it hits, no amount of farming will save you. I gotta go.
Holding hands
midnight, neath a starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Jett Stanford Junior University, copyright 2019.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pamintuan. Special thanks to Merle Kessler, Micah Cash, Conchita Perales, Lauren Burghardt, and Rachel Cousing.
Thanks also to our musical guests, Matt Clark on piano, David Yule on bass, Sly Randolph on drums, and the one and only Tiffany Austin on vocals.
The senior producer of Philosophy Talk is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Cindy Prince-Baum. Dan Brandon is the technical director.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or our other funders.
Not even when they're true or reasonable. The conversation continues on our website.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Loving one who loves you, and then taking that vow. Nice work if you can get it, and if you get it, won't you tell me how?